This is Drew Mackey, and you're listening to Singing Mountain. For a nerdy teenager in the 1990s, the word Squaresoft was magic. I'm not talking about some sort of Billy Every Teen here. I'm specifically talking about myself. I am the nerdy teenager. The titles produced by Square were doorways into the types of fantasy worlds that I didn't see too often in the US, at least back then. Before I knew about steampunk and Miyazaki, the way a lot of these games would combine medieval and contemporary aesthetics seemed really novel to me and really appealing. I devoured the games that Square brought over to the United States, and as exciting as it was to get my hands on a new game, there's this other thing. The tantalizing magic of getting a glimpse of a game that wouldn't ever make it overseas. If you're younger than me, you might not remember the golden age of video game magazines. There were a lot, diehard game fan being the best, and they'd occasionally offer a screenshot or two from some Squaresoft creation that never made it outside Japan. Those screenshots would just be all you get, you know, because the internet wasn't then what it is today, and I would pore over them trying to get every detail I could. Did you ever watch that show Fringe? The sci-fi one on Fox that wasn't The X-Files, but kind of was The X-Files? One of the things that show did was parallel universes, the red universe and the blue universe. One was ours, and the other one was slightly different, and it had different pop culture products than ours had. Like, Eric Stoltz never got recast in Back to the Future over there, and the Dodgers never moved to Los Angeles, and Crisis on Infinite Earths had Supergirl holding up a dead Superman rather than the other way around. These Japan-only Squaresoft games feel like that to me. Weird versions of things that looked familiar, games that looked like Final Fantasy but weren't, but that we just never had access to. The irony of me saying all this is that we did end up actually getting them, if not in officially translated form for the Super Nintendo, then on subsequent systems, and even if we didn't get that, at least we have fan translations now, and a lot of them are actually quite good. I have to say though, it is hard for me to park myself in front of my computer and play a translated ROM, and I'm betting there are a lot of you out there who wish they could have played these games but haven't got around to doing it yet. Hence, this episode, Square Over There, which is about all the Super Famicom era Squaresoft releases that never made it outside Japan. I got the idea for doing this episode when I was putting together episode 52, which was all tracks from Live Alive, a Yoko Shimomura composed Square RPG that we never got in the US. I'll be playing some more tracks from that game later in this episode, but while I was making the first one, I realized that I could probably give people a musical sampler of all the RPGs we didn't get here, so that the ROM-averse like me could at least experience a small part of these games. They sound good. They sound like Square games, and they'll probably induce that kind of weird feeling you get when you have a vague nostalgia for something you know you didn't ever actually experience, but it's because they, like Final Fantasy and Chrono Trigger and Secret of Mana, represent what Square felt like back then. I'm not going to do Seiken Densetsu 3 in this episode because I did it way back in episode 8 and I did it in pretty considerable depth. So just go listen to that if you want to know about the Secret of Mana sequel we never got in the United States sounded like. I'm also not going to do Final Fantasy V just because I feel like there's not too much I can really say about that game. This episode is all deeper cuts than that. I guess the first block of songs isn't really deep cuts just because they're all Romancing Saga, and all but the third Romancing Saga game has been released in the United States, and I feel like we're probably going to get an announcement about the third one getting translated for here pretty soon. Romancing Saga is also the series that most resembles Final Fantasy. It is essentially the spiritual spinoff to Final Fantasy II, which is the one with the wonky level-up system that Square subsequently abandoned for the Final Fantasy games, but which revived for the Game Boy series Final Fantasy Legend, which in Japan is known as Makai Toshi Saga. So yeah, Romancing Saga is the 16-bit upgrade to Final Fantasy Legend in the way Secret of Mana is the 16-bit upgrade to Final Fantasy Adventure. I've played Romancing Saga 2 and 3, and they're good. 3 especially is beautiful, with more detailed sprites than you'd see in Final Fantasy VI. But as someone who learned RPG mechanics through Final Fantasy, they can be a little tough because the level-up system is kind of opaque and confusing. I'm usually like, why have I just learned a new skill? How did that happen? Was it random? That said, I probably would give number 3 another shot when and if it gets translated into English on the Switch. All three Romancing Saga games are composed by Kenji Ito, and the block I'm going to play for you has two from the first game, Destined Fate and Bard's Tale, both of which are compositions Ito would revisit in later games. Then I'm going to play three tracks from Romancing Saga 3. First is Julian's theme. Julian is one of the 8 main characters you can play as in this game, but he's basically only interesting because he has green hair. There's not a whole lot else there. His theme, though, is awesome. More awesome than he is, you might say. Then it's Harid's theme. Harid is very cool. He's a prince of a desert kingdom, and unique for a JRPG from this era, he's not light-skinned. Square actually put some melanin in his pixels, and I'm struggling to think of a central playable character in another Japanese-made RPG from this era that didn't look either Asian or Caucasian. So thank you to whoever lobbied for that. At last, I'm going to play Magical Tank Battle, which is the music you hear when you fight an evil enchanted tank top. In late 1993, a few months before Final Fantasy VI came out in Japan, Square put out Alkahest, an action RPG that I describe broadly as Legend of Zelda-like, but more specifically like Secret of Mana had a baby with the Genesis game Beyond Oasis, at least as far as character design goes. There's not that much about this one online, really, though it does feature a party member who is a princess with maybe one of the worst names I've ever heard in a video game. Elixhell. That has to be a mistranslation. Sorry if your mom's name happens to be Elixhell, but it's even weirder when you see that the hero is just named Alan. I'm Alan, the hero. It's not great names here. What is good about this game is that it was developed by HAL, the company that makes the Kirby games, and the soundtrack is by Jun Ishikawa. This is actually one of the few non-Kirby games on his gameography, and it sounds great. Actually sounds a lot like Kirby's Dream Land 3, which is maybe my favorite Kirby soundtrack. In order, I'll be playing Overworld, Cave, and then Dungeon, all composed by Jun Ishikawa, all from Alkahest.
Thank you.
while I was putting together episode 52, the Live Alive episode, I set aside a few tracks for this episode. If you want to know more about Live Alive, just listen to episode 52. All you really need to know is that it's a bunch of different vignettes set in different points in history. And as a result, the soundtrack is very eclectic. It's all by Yoko Shimomura, who mostly does RPGs now, but who also composed the Street Fighter 2 soundtrack. And you really hear that connection in the first track I'm going to play, Knock You Down. I'm also going to play Native Life, which comes from the prehistory era, Sancho de los Panchos, which in Spanish means nothing, and which is from the Wild West era, Painful Death at the Hands of a Psycho, which I know nothing about, but has a great name, and finally, Pure Odio, which is a boss theme. In lieu of rehashing anything I went over in episode 52, I will just say this to you right now. Have you given this podcast a rate and review? Yes, I am pausing mid-episode to ask you to give me a review on iTunes because I've only gotten one so far this year and I like them. I like reviews. I read all of them to myself and then I also read them in future episodes. So if you want to write something weird and make me say it in a future episode, now's your chance. Go to iTunes and go wild. So sorry for that brief public service announcement. No, self-promotion announcement, but enjoy all these Live Alive tracks. We'll be right back. 1995, Square released the first of the Front Mission series, which is a tactical RPG series with a decidedly non-fantasy setting. The first game takes place in 2099 in our world, and it's not especially my thing, not my flavor of game, just because it's a little gray and a little military-ish, but the music is good. The soundtrack was a joint effort by Yoko Shimomura and Noriko Matsueda. I feel like Front Mission became more of a thing once it transitioned to the PlayStation, but before that happened, Square put out one more on the Super Famicom, Front Mission Series : Gun Hazard, which is a weird shooter, side-scroller, RPG hybrid with a fantastic soundtrack by Nobuo Uematsu, Yatsunori Masuda, Masashi Hamazu, and Junya Nakano. I feel like this game deserves its own 30-minute episode because there's a lot on here that's great, and it was actually hard to pick one over another. In fact, the opening track for this episode was Tension from this game by Nobuo Uematsu. So for this block, I will be playing in order Coaxial Town from Front Mission by Yoko Shimomura, Shop from Front Mission by Noriko Matsueda because I love a good shop theme, Richard Millman from Front Mission Gun Hazard by Uematsu and sounding a lot like the work he'd be doing on Final Fantasy VII, then Approaching to a Shrine from Gun Hazard by Masashi Hamazu, and then finally Trial Zone by Yasunori Masuda, which reminds me a great deal of a Chrono Trigger track. Enjoy. if Front Mission was a tactical strategy RPG that wasn't fantastical at all, then Bahamut Lagoon was the tactical RPG that inherited all of that unused fantasy. As the name would imply, dragons play a big role in this game, both in story and combat. It's a very pretty looking game, and the soundtrack is by Noriko Matsueda, working solo here. She, by the way, also did Final Fantasy X-2 and then didn't work again, that I can find. I don't know why. One of the main characters in Bahamut Lagoon is a princess named either Jojo or Yo-Yo, depending on who's doing the translating, and I can't actually decide which name I like better. Her theme is first, and then it's the theme of the kingdom Kana, and then it's sub-battle, a sub-boss battle theme, I'm guessing, and a battle theme I really like, which is saying a lot because I don't really put a lot of battle themes on the show. Then it's Requiem, and then finally a reprise of Yo-Yo's theme, Yo-Yo and the Dragons, which would be a great band name, by the way, and which I like so much I had to include it as well. Both versions strike a different vibe, and I think they sound great. Also, have you played this game? If so, please answer a question for me. Sendak, the wise old wizard character, he's gay, right? Like, he hits on the hero? I have been told this is the case, but I'm hoping someone who's actually played the game could tell me if it's, like, something that's said outright, or it's just implied, or it's maybe just a translation quirk. Do you know? Please tell me. I want to know. Anyway, think about that while you listen to Bahamut Lagoon. By some counts, the last Square creation released for the Super Famicom was Rudra no Hiho, or Treasure of the Rudras, a game whose plot seems sprawling. It focuses on three different lead characters in the final few days before the apocalypse, and you play them in whatever order you want, though actions by one character can affect scenarios encountered by other characters down the road. Of all the games I'm spotlighting in this episode, this is the one I'd be most interested in playing, just because it seems so grand. It also has a truly unique magic system that I've read about but still don't really understand, where magic is cast by learning spell words, though you can also come up with your own spells just by trying out various combinations of letters. Treasure of the Rudras also looks amazing. It's about as good as anything you'd see in Nintendo's 16-bit era, and as you're about to hear, it sounds amazing as well. The soundtrack is by Ryuji Sasai, and again, it's one of the best ever of the 16-bit era. And it's really too bad that Sasai's career making video game music seems to have ended pretty shortly after this game. 2002's Bushido Blade, a Squaresoft release, was the last game he composed for. After that, he seems to have left Square and the industry altogether. And that's a bummer, because this is great. This is great in a way that you'd think he would have become like a household name composer had he persisted, but it just didn't happen. I don't know why. I have no context for where in the game you'd hear any of the following songs, but these are the six tracks I'm going to play for you. Beginning for the End, then Between Two Worlds, parentheses, Night, then Crime of the Heart, then Take the Gold and Run, parentheses, Night, then Underworld, and then finally Whistle Down the Wind, all of which are from Treasure of the Rudras, all of which are composed by Ryuji Sasai. Thank you. So I said Treasure of the Rudras is maybe the last purely Square effort for the Super Famicom, and really for any Nintendo system for quite a while. But there's also Treasure Hunter G, published by Square but developed by Sting and released May 24th, 1996, a few weeks after Treasure of the Rudras. I've heard this game isn't bad, but I don't know too much about it, other than it revolves around brothers named Red and blue is not colored blue, and that is problematic to me. You can also play as a monkey wizard, though, and that's kind of cool. Treasure Hunter G was composed by Hitoshi Sakamoto, Masaharu Iwata, Toshiaki Sakoda, Yoko Takada, Tomoko Matsui, Akiko Goto, and John P, as in P-E-E, which is either a pseudonym, but why would you pick P as your name? And if it's the guy's real name, why not use a pseudonym? I really don't know what's happening there. And just picking my favorite tracks, however, John P actually came up quite a few times. So in spite of that name, he's a good composer. John P and Yoko Takada are the only two artists who are going to be represented in this episode. You're going to be hearing, Well, Let's Get Out There and Fight by Yoko Takada. Then The World's Cavern 1 by John P. Then Just Like the Mountain, He Will Not Move by John P. Then Whose Cat Is This by Yoko Takada. Please, someone tell me why there's a track called Whose Cat Is This? I want to know. And then finally, Sad Freedom by John P. John P., I salute you. I take back everything I said about your stupid name. It's great. We'll be right back. And that's it. I hope you enjoyed this little adventure through the officially translated Squaresoft games that never were. This period of video games means a lot to me, and I hope it's something you can connect with too. If you have any questions, comments, or criticisms about Singing Mountain, the easiest way to reach me is on Twitter, either at Drew G. Mackey, M-A-C-K-I-E, or at Singmopod, S-I-N-G-M-O-P-O-D. You can also follow Singing Mountain on Facebook. Just search for Singing Mountain and click on the one that's not a bakery. And if you like pixel art, Singing Mountain is on Instagram at Singing Mountain Pod. Please subscribe. And if you like the show, give me a rate and review, please, because those are helpful for the reasons you hear on every podcast ever. On that subject, if you know someone who loves this era of RPGs, would you mind sending them this episode? Like, just send them the link and, hey, I think you really dig this, and that's it. That's actually probably the best way I can increase the number of people that listen to my show, because your friends are going to trust your personal recommendations beyond anything that's going to come up via like an algorithm or something. So yeah, if you know anyone, do me a solid and like send this episode to them. Hopefully they like it too. Singing Mountain is a Table Kicks podcast. Table Kicks is a Los Angeles-based podcast network that features some really cool shows, including two others that I host. Check them all out at tablecakes.com. If you want to support Singing Mountain or any of the shows on the Table Kicks network, please do so at patreon.com/tablecakes. I have one last track for you. It's from Treasure of the Rudras, which had so many great tracks that, again, I don't think you should be surprised if you see a 30-minute episode coming up in the nearest future. And again, I have no context. This one is called King of the Mountain, and it sounds amazing. And I guess I should probably play Treasure of the Rudras to find out why it exists and what event it was made to, be the soundtrack to. But to close out this episode, one last from Treasure of the Rudras, King of the Mountain by Ryuji Sasai. See ya.